We all want a healthy heart, lungs, and brain. Can you guess at the single behavior that connects the dots on solving the ability to run or ride at the same speed using 25% less breathing? Reducing the occurrence of the so-called exercise-induced asthma or bronchoconstriction, EIB? Eliminating side stitches while running? Avoiding frequent sinus infections and bronchitis? And even dodging AFib and dementia? And what if it cost you nothing but your attention? Well, listen to this. The latest science is showing us that while breathing with an open mouth allows for an increase in ventilation, increase in work capacity, think VO2 max, and actually feels more comfortable and normal, yet doing so also predisposes us to a variety of potential health problems over time. That's right. Today, we are going to talk about nasal breathing. And while nasal breathing may have fallen off the internet talk circuit as a popular biohack, wise athletes should never walk away from low-hanging fruit. So coming back onto our show on episode 143 is the one and only Dr. George Dallam, who joins us to walk us through his personal benefits from adapting to nasal breathing nearly 20 years ago, and to update us on all the latest research into the health and physical performance benefits available to us all. All without ingesting any chemicals, or changing our diet, or buying a single thing. All you have to do is breathe through your nose. It's a simple prescription. If only it was easy to learn. All right, let's talk to Dr. Dallam, author of the just-published book, The Nasal Breathing Paradox During Exercise. Dr. George Dallam, welcome back to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Happy to be here, Joe. Good to see you.
It's been a couple of years. I have to tell you that two things. One is that the whole nasal breathing thing, even though I think maybe the world maybe has started to move on, it's sort of like, you know, the other cold plunge or something. I still feel like it's one of those major levers of my health and athletic performance. And so I am still after it, thinking about how to breathe through my nose as much of the day and the night as I can. And I've had a lot of success. I have not managed to get fully adapted to it, I regret to admit. And one of the things I'm hoping to get out of talking to you again is another burst of motivation to keep pushing that way.
While the media may be moving on from this to some degree and, you know, that sort of world, it's actually now got greatly increased interest in exercise physiology. So in particular, there's a group at Baylor who have published four or five experimental studies, all emanating from a couple of different trials they did, that is just excellent, all looking at this question. And so actually, the fact that it's moved on in the media is less concerning to me than the fact that now some of the scientists are beginning to embrace the idea, hey, we need to look at this idea, you know, not just me and one or two other people.
Awesome. Well, and of course, I know about this Baylor study since you and I have been chatting, and that is the main new thing that I want to talk about. Last time, I was really mostly interested in the athletic performance aspect to it, and wisely, you kept talking about the health benefits of it, which of course, you know, I gave lip service to, yeah, that's important too, right? But more and more over the last few years, I have really come around to the whole perspective of a healthy athlete is a strong athlete. And that my goal is not to just be as a good athlete now, but for a long time. You know, at my age, I think I'm probably about halfway through my time on Earth, but I've already had to start compensating for declines. And nasal breathing is one of those things that seems to be so fundamental that it provides benefit in many ways. Health, longevity, maybe. We're going to talk about brain health. Neurological disease is one of the bad ones, but also as a bonus, athletic performance.
So I'm historically a performance coach, and when people come at me about this topic, oftentimes they're really interested in that piece of it. That to me is the least interesting thing, right? The most interesting thing, because I'm also a exercise science kind of professor, right? Our classes are all about health, right? And about how we can use exercise to improve our health. The most interesting thing is the sort of myriad of ways that how we breathe influences our health, both either positively or negatively, depending on whether we breathe correctly, which we could simplify to breathing through our nose, or whether we breathe incorrectly, which we could simplify to breathing primarily through our mouths. It's just astounding how many things are impacted. I'm not just talking about at rest. You know, now that we're looking at the idea that maybe we can do this during exercise, many things are impacted during exercise as well. So, you know, one of the longest chapters in my book is actually about one of the deleterious health effects of breathing orally in the way that almost everybody does when they exercise at higher intensities.
Well, that's great. In fairness to the people who have not listened to the previous podcast, I think that we should touch on some of the high points you know, that you've talked about in your book, which is new since our last chat, but also just it's just amazing the number, the myths that, you know, people carry around in their head, things that they always knew that turn out to just be false. And then just the, you know, what does the nose do for us? I mean, why do we have this big honking thing? It's not to hold my glasses up, I don't think, although it does a good job with that. But, you know, what does it do for us, and why, when we don't use it properly, why is it bad for us? I'd like to get some of that. I don't want to spend the whole time talking about that because I want to make sure we get into two other things. One is this brain health thing, which we've alluded to, and also would like to talk to you about some other things that have been on my mind for, another a year or so that maybe are related to this, you know, hypoxia training and, you know, altitude training. And is there some connection to all of that? And maybe the answer is no, and that's a short conversation, but I'd love to spend a little time on that if we have it. Why don't you, first of all, for the audience, George, tell the audience about your background, because talking about wise athletes, you are the wise athlete.
So I got involved in competitive swimming when I was six. My mom was a swim coach, and all of my older brothers and sister all swam as well. And I've been training year round, first in swimming at about 10, 11. I also started playing water polo, did all of that through the NCAA at Texas A&M, continued to swim and enter triathlon. My water polo career ended a bit prematurely, and triathlon started emerging about, as a thing beyond San Diego in about 1980-81. So I started doing triathlons because I needed something to do. The first year of that was also a lot of bike racing, and then I continued that for 2 or 3 years. Along the way, I did some wrestling. I've done a lot of athletics, and I've done it continuously. I've never stopped being an athlete, and so here I am at 65 still going and racing, right? I'm going to go to a race in another week up in Boulder. So I have a long background that way. My mom put a copy of what's called a book called The Science of Swimming, which was Doc Councilman's most famous book. If you're familiar, he's the great coach of Mark Spitz at Indiana, 7 NCAA championships in a row. He was like an icon in the sport at the time, and also somebody I had some direct connection to because I started going to a swim camps and working there when I was about 15 at Mercersburg, and later went to school there. And Doc came there every year to work in those swim camps. And so, I was put on that road of being a sports scientist very, very early. So I've been on that road my entire life, really.
That's great. And how did you get into the whole nasal breathing thing, George?
So as a young swimmer, particularly, you know, you get lots of upper respiratory infections. By the time I think I was about 12, I had pneumonia. In those days, this is in, this would be in the early 70s. In those days, a child with pneumonia was considered really serious because pneumonia people died from. The walking pneumonia concept had not really yet emerged. So, you know, they made me stay home for 4 weeks and do nothing, right? So I did that. First time in my life I'd ever gone that long without being involved in sport or something like that. And then I went back and ran in track and field day and got killed. And I was like out of breath and thinking this is horrible. So that cemented in my mind. I didn't really want to be sick like that, but I continued to have those upper respiratory problems all the way up until about 2005, right, where I'd already been teaching and doing triathlon for like 25 years at that point. You know, I'd have multiple bronchitis at altitude. I started having sinus infections and pneumonia periodically, right, just stuff that, you know, is miserable. So one day I sort of opened my mind up because all the traditional medical stuff had not worked. That's a whole story of itself. And I came across this idea of breathing nasally and using a neti pot every day, not using it when you get sick, using it every day. And I just started doing that. And I experienced initially that I could hardly do any work breathing nasally, but I started realizing I was adapting and I just kept going. I'm kind of stubborn, right? And I also stopped getting sick. And a year later, I'm running faster than I had in quite a while. I'm cycling faster than I had in quite a while, all breathing nasally, and I haven't been sick. And then for the next 3 or 4 years, I still never got sick, even like once. So I, you know, got really interested in this, started talking to athletes I coached and my students, and other people started doing the same thing. And eventually we had enough people who had done this to do a study, right? To take a look at them and see, can you actually produce as much work breathing nasally as orally? So that's the study that's caught the most interest here, right? And people get confused about that. They think I took a group of people and said, do this for 6 months. I didn't do that. I just kept track of people who were adapted. And then we put them together in a study eventually once we had, and some of them, like myself, I had done this for a long, long time. Others had only, you know, they were current students, had only done this that minimum amount, 6 months. But basically, we were able to show that after adapt to this, you can produce just as much work nasally as orally.
So it's not just the obvious where you were not getting sick as much, and so you were training more consistently, which would naturally give you better results. Do you think that was the main thing, or do you think that it really was by just breathing differently, your in-the-moment performance was better?
So I did think that for a long time, Joe. That was my immediate explanation. It's the logical explanation, right? Because I was training more consistently. I didn't have those frequent periods of detraining because I had gotten sick. And I didn't really change that view until we did the study. And then in the study, we saw how much more economic this was. And then I realized, you know, this is something more than not just getting sick. Potentially, this is the idea that you have improved economy. Now, we're kind of going down the performance trail here. There's no definitive performance data. Even our study is not definitive. We just showed that at a high-level steady state, when in people adapted breathing nasally, that they're more economic. They use less oxygen. And the reason they do so is they're ventilating about 25% less. So we suspect that that leads to a small performance gain, you know, 2 or 3% maybe. I experienced that. I, you know, experienced that after I adapted, I was actually going faster than I had in a while. But that's anecdotal, right? I have seen that anecdotal result in a number of other people as well. We still don't have that. We can't say that definitively at this point, that you're going to improve performance. But going back to your sort of earlier point, that almost doesn't matter. In fact, for most athletes, even if they could just get near what they could do before, that actually is important because that means that they can continue to train or exercise in a way where they're not damaging themselves in the same way, right? So let's say in your case, you don't feel like you've adapted to do your highest levels of work breathing nasally, but if you're still doing most of your work breathing nasally, you're doing something that's probably going to extend your ability to exercise for, you know, a considerable amount, limit the morbidity associated with exercise, right? And there is some morbidity, meaning disease. There is some disease associated with exercise. So really interesting, one of the most obvious things is people get sick a lot more frequently, especially hard training people. Like if you look at a cross-country program or a swimming program, the upper respiratory frequency is very, very high, higher than the normal population oftentimes. And this seems to resolve that. That's one of the most basic benefits, is that if you're breathing nasally, you're far less likely to experience that.
Okay, well, one way or another, it seems like a really good thing. And to get both seems almost too good to be true. But I'm a believer in it. I mean, I do the neti pot every day. I used to get sinus infections all the time. And even before the nasal breathing thing became a thing in my mind, after talking to you, the neti pot itself just ended my sinus infections and my bronchitises that I would get every time I get a cold. You know, maybe not every time, but often I would get a bronchitis. And that just does not happen anymore. And that was before I started trying to be a healthy person. So there's something about getting the nasal passages working properly that's somehow important to our health.
Let me talk about that for a minute, Joe. So portion of the book, I address the neti pot research. You know, most people in this country think about a neti pot as something they use when they get sick. So you get a cold and you got congestion, I'm going to go get a neti pot and try to clean that out. But it's really too late at that point. So use of a neti pot that way will help to reduce your symptoms, but it can't stop the infection, right? So how we actually get infections, which we now better understand finally is maybe the one upside of COVID, is through aerosol. We inhale, viral particles, bacterial particles, whatever the thing is that's acting as a pathogen for us, into our nasal passage. It's captured in the mucus. And over several days, it enters the goblet cells, takes over the DNA, and replicates itself. And it takes 2 or 3 days usually to accumulate enough of that to reach a viral load where you'll then feel it as a systemic infection. So the thing is, if you remove that mucus daily, right, and you remove it with just an easy flow of water that has some antimicrobial material, and the most common thing being salt, that you prevent that whole development from ever happening, which is why when you start using a neti pot every day, you're not really using it for symptoms. You're using it to prevent getting sick in the first place, which is probably why you're experiencing what I've experienced. I just don't get sick very readily, right? It's difficult for me to get an upper respiratory infection. Knock on wood, but you know, it's the reality is it's been so many years now, I no longer even think about it. I just don't get those. Even when people who, you know, I'm still an undergrad teacher with like 40 students in front of me. And that sick kid coming up right into my face saying, I'm going to miss class. I don't feel right. And I'll say, you need to go home, man. Go sleep. So in theory, I should still be getting sick. I have lots of exposure, right? But I don't.
That's really good. My mom was a school teacher. And so I'm very familiar with the perils of teaching. And I think more and more the science is starting to understand that your cumulative viral load over your life is a longevity reducer.
Ah, okay. I'm actually not familiar with that, so that's an interesting thing to hear.
Yeah. So fewer illnesses is not just a more convenient, less of a pain in the neck. It's a good for your health. Okay, so one thing I wanted to touch on, and then I wanted to, you know, just have you tell us, you know, more of the high level gems about, you know, the nasal breathing. You had said something which I sort of remember from our last conversation, but it just struck me as sort of amazing. And so I wanted to hit on it. And that was this idea of, you said that by nasal breathing, you're breathing 25% less. And I thought, well, okay, what is happening? Because, you know, when if I use a pulse ox and I'm looking at my, blood, my oxygenation of my blood, it's always pretty good. And if I was to hyperventilate, it might go up a tiny little bit. So if I'm mouth breathing instead of nasal breathing and I'm breathing 25% more, say if I go the other way, I'm not getting more oxygen.
No, you're not.
I must be getting some other effect from breathing so much more. What is happening, and is that good or bad?
So there's a little complex physiology here, but I'm going to simplify it into this. When we hyperventilate or ventilate more than is really necessary, that favors CO2 removal, right? Meaning that CO2 levels in our blood tend to drop. It doesn't favor oxygen uptake, though. In fact, it can, if we hyperventilate to a really high level, it can actually start to inhibit oxygen uptake. When we hypoventilate, meaning that we breathe a little less than normal, that favors O2 uptake and doesn't favor CO2 removal. In fact, it inhibits CO2 removal a bit. So our CO2 levels start to rise in the blood and we tend to optimize. Now there is a level of hypoventilation, right? Dramatically below normal, where we actually start to then compromise. Literally think about that. If I just try to breathe once every 5 minutes, of course I'm not going to take as much oxygen up. But within the range of, you know, what we see in human beings when they breathe through their nose or their mouth, right? If they breathe through their nose, they're hypoventilating a bit relative to what is normal for them if they breathe through their mouth. Yet oxygen uptake is not compromised at all, right? But what is compromised a bit is CO2 out. So you're thinking, well, that's got to be bad, right? You know, the classic physiology text, CO2 is a waste gas. CO2 is an end product of metabolism, not a waste gas. So like all things in the body, it has to be kept in homeostasis, right? Even oxygen out of homeostasis is damaging to the body. Right, creates perioxidation, starts to damage our DNA, et cetera. So, we have to maintain a homeostatic value of CO2, but we want that homeostatic value to be fairly high because what it does is actually vasodilate our blood vessels and improves our blood flow, right? It also is involved in the hemoglobin binding process, right? Most people have learned about hemoglobin and oxygen because that's how they teach it in an undergraduate anatomy class, but hemoglobin actually binds CO2, it binds nitric oxide. Really, any gas that enters the blood has to bind to hemoglobin because you can't dissolve gases in fluids, really. So they have to bind to proteins, right? So hemoglobin multiply binds things and, you know, CO2 influences that. That's not the big thing, though. In my mind, the big thing is its vasodilating effect, right? It's maybe the most important thing we're coming to understand now, that if we breathe nasally, we have these higher levels of CO2, which we would call a slightly hypercapnic environment, right? We're actually doing multiple things that are good for us because we're just improving blood flow everywhere. And we can handle that, right? Because when we breathe nasally, we don't have to work at breathing as much. We don't, that 25 or really about 22% less near VO2 max, that 22% less breathing, that's all energy and blood flow. So if I have to breathe considerably less, I have plenty of blood to then provide more blood to my brain and to my heart, right? Does that make sense? That's a complicated idea. I get it, right? Even a lot of the physiologists I was trained with, they don't understand this at all. Right. But, you know, they're starting to think about it now because we never, you know, in my field, people never even thought about CO2. They just waste gas, don't think about it. Right.
Well, that's very interesting. And some of that, I think, rings a bell from the last time we spoke. So thanks for the update on that. So I think that where we ought to do is let's talk about some of the, you know, the high level stuff that about the nasal breathing, why it's good. We've touched on some of it already. You know, why don't we talk about a few of the benefits of nasal breathing? And maybe, you know, people could be in their mind imagining that the other side of the, you know, the other column next to it could be the opposite, which is the detriments of mouth breathing. What would you say are the number one, two, and three major benefits?
So I would talk about first, and I'll use some anecdotal observations of people I know. There's a guy by the name of Dave Scott. He's, you know, considered the best triathlete, and especially in long distance racing all the time. Dave's had problems with his heart for a number of years and then reported in the media recently he's going in to have a surgery, basically because he's got a fibrotic heart, right? Which means he probably has arrhythmia problems. They didn't go into details, but, you know, kind of we know what the story is. I have another friend right now who I'm, you know, trying to encourage to change breathing. I won't mention that person specifically, but because they also have the same thing. They recently showed up with an arrhythmia and, you know, they're a long-term triathlete. They have a fibrotic heart, right? So why do you get a fibrotic heart? So fiber in the heart or scar tissue for your listener is basically only ever formed either from a direct mechanical blow because you damage it like you might damage a hamstring, or from what's called ischemia. So ischemia means a lack of blood flow resulting in a lack of oxygen. It's basically what a heart attack is when ischemia is really extreme, right? Your heart muscle has to continue to work continuously throughout your life. So if enough of it goes without blood flow, meaning without oxygen, it dies. We call that infarction. So heart attacks are myocardial infarctions. But it's also the case that if it goes with less than optimal blood flow, that creates some ischemia and that you start to see some fibrosis developing, right? So what's been really interesting in the last 15 or 20 years is the continually increasing finding that people like myself have fibrotic hearts. You know, you consider, well, that's a really highly trained person. They should be supremely healthy in terms of their cardiovascular fitness. Yet when studied, their hearts have more than normal scar tissue on them. Yet we haven't been able to explain that, right? In cardiology, they, you know, what they basically say is, well, it's just from exercising too much, or maybe from exercising too hard too much. But they have no real explanation for how that created that ischemia, because otherwise that person's heart is extraordinarily capable of deriving blood flow. So one of the things that we now can better understand from this Baylor study that you mentioned earlier is that when we breathe orally and create a relatively higher level of ventilation, particularly at high levels of work, past what, you know, some of your listeners might understand as the anaerobic threshold, you know, maybe past your mile pace, you know, at faster things, or maybe past even your 5K pace. We create a relatively higher level of ventilation than we have been creating previously. So that means that we're creating that condition that favors CO2 removal, which means CO2 levels are not going to be as high as they would if we weren't breathing quite as much. So, you know, we've known for, I think, at least 40 years from experimental work, at rest, when you do that, you can compromise blood flow in the heart and in the brain, right? And so there's multiple experimental papers I talk about in the book showing that at rest. And in fact, let's say you have a person who has some pre-existing atherosclerosis, but also subject to panic attacks. On occasion, they'll die in a panic attack because when they start breathing really fast through their mouth in the panic attack and get a little vasoconstriction in the myocardium, they get ischemic enough to just then arrest, right, to die, to have an infarct at the point adequate to cause them to arrest. So, you know, it's very possible that this is happening during exercise, that what's happening to people like myself and maybe to some degree yourself when we were breathing orally and doing fairly high level work is we're actually creating ischemic episodes every time we did that. And that's creating these fibrotic patches over time so that our hearts are becoming more scarred over time.
Yeah.
So the most immediate repercussion of that is atrial fibrillation, which probably most of your listeners not only know about, if they're people like you and me, they're like freaked out about it probably, because now it's like everybody seems to have atrial fibrillation.
Very common.
Well, how do you get an arrhythmia from scar tissue? The heart doesn't have nerves moving through it, right? It basically just, the muscle tissue just conducts the electron flux that causes contraction or the, you know, the change in polarity of the membrane cell to cell, right, without having any nerve. So some of those cells start to become fibrotic or scar tissue. Those are like non-conductive patches that get in the way of that electron flow. And then that causes the electron flow not to go in an efficient manner. And that's really where arrhythmias potentially come from, right? So if what we're doing basically by breathing orally is creating these fibrotic hearts that also then result in arrhythmias, you know, that's problematic. Now, what's interesting is there's no evidence yet that people who have done this to themselves are dying at higher rates than normals. There's what I would call weak evidence that they might be dying at higher rates than people who are exercising more moderately. Although I say it's weak evidence because it's based on a very small group of people who exercise, you know, extensively. And people who exercise extensively oftentimes are different in a variety of other ways as well that might also contribute to their health. So we don't really know that this is causing us to die earlier, but we do know it's problematic, right? Like my friend, you know, she's not really happy to have a physician telling her, you have to change how you do everything now because you're going into these arrhythmias. And Dave, I'm sure he's not, I haven't talked to him, but I'm sure he's not happy about this. You know, I have actually, well, one other good friend, who, you know, great triathlete from a long time ago who actually went through really an extreme version of this almost 20 years ago and has had to have ablation surgeries and implanted defibrillators, you know, ever since. And there's a famous triathlete who, I won't mention his name either, but he's also had the same condition cause him to drop out. And then there are multiple others, right? I can think of I can't think of names at the second, and I wouldn't use them anyways, but there are three or four other athletes I've read reports about who have dropped out of triathlon because they started developing arrhythmia. So, you know, we don't have evidence of this in the heart yet. What we're saying is that now we have evidence of this happening in the cerebrum. The mechanism is the same, right? CO2, once it's accumulating the blood, is impacting your circulation in all tissues of the body. It's not localized, right? I mean, it's streaming out of cells, but then when you have a higher arterial level, that means you're getting general vasodilation. So if we're improving blood flow in the brain, right, by breathing nasally at a given relative effort, we're probably also improving blood flow in the heart. And again, I'll remind the listener that that's probably possible, partly because of the fact that we're also not having to breathe as much or do as much work of breathing. So there is more blood flow available to allow for this to happen. Right.
Interesting.
So I would say that's a biggie. There's a related biggie, which we can talk about more definitively because there's a study showing us this now. The Baylor study shows us that at a given relative workload, and that means they weren't doing the same absolute amount of work because their subjects were not adapted, right? They weren't able to do as much work breathing nasally. But if we compare their workload to the VO2 max in the condition, at a given relative workload, they had a higher level of cerebral blood flow. So why is that important, right? You can think more clearly while you're exercising, but maybe the more important idea is that, you know, the best single behavioral mechanism that we can relate to the development of cognitive disorders later on, whether we want to call that dementia or Alzheimer's, you know, stuff that we don't actually fully understand how it happens beyond the idea we have these tau proteins that accumulating in the brain, the best protective thing seems to be exercise. So we have any number of studies showing us that people with higher levels of aerobic exercise capacity and or practice have lower rates of cognitive disorder of this type. And we also have a couple of experimental trials showing us that you can improve or reduce the loss basically of cognitive ability using aerobic exercise trials. We really have no medication that does that. The recent thing that came out, we're talking like a 10% improvement, right? It's almost meaningless. So how would that work? Well, one of the theories is that the primary way that we create neogenesis in the, I think it's the word they use is neogenesis, or the new development of the neurons in the brain is by increasing blood flow into the brain. So aerobic exercise clearly does that. It stimulates new cell development in the brain. And then the second basic thought is that these proteins that accumulate in the brain are byproducts of a metabolic process that's happening. And the reason that they may be accumulating is because we're not flushing them out enough with regular blood flow. And so why this might be a thing that's incurring more and more in increasingly sedentary societies is because they don't do the things that allow them to keep their brain in homeostasis in terms of these proteins that are emerging. So exercise does that anyway, right? Even if I breathe through my mouth, I'll get better blood flow from my brain than I will just being at rest. But if I do that breathing nasally, I improve that even more, right? So this becomes a way that, and I won't try to say that aerobic exercise breathing orally won't be protective, but this might make breathing nasally allow that exercise to be even more protective for brain health, and or a way to better treat people who are brain injured. My son's been brain injured, right? And so one of the most important things I try to get across to him is we have to get out and walk and do aerobic exercise to try to, and we have to breathe nasally, which he was trained in from the time he ran track in middle school, right? So that's a routine thing for him to try to, allow your brain to recover, to stimulate this neogenesis, this development of new cells in the brain. So, I can't speak because this is just anecdotal. It's just his experience. But, he's improved a lot, right? And I think that's a piece of it, right?
Well, that's great. And it's got to be more than just the heart and the brain that is better off with better blood flow. The blood flow is how the waste products get taken away and the nutrients come in, and all kinds of things don't function as well when they don't get enough blood flow. I mean, I think erectile dysfunction and, older men start to lose the hair on their lower legs, and, all kinds of things start to go wrong when the blood flow is starting to decrease.
That's true, right? And so that's why there's this, in the people who are studying this concept at a resting level, right, which has become a really big topic in physiology, not in exercise physiology, in physiology, people who study resting metabolism, resting physiology, it's very clear that there's like a myriad of benefits of simply making sure that you're breathing nasally all the time. So, very likely there's a myriad of benefits that could be occurring in health. The two really important ones that we understand relative to blood flow are the limitation of blood flow of the brain is to some degree overcome, and the limitation of, we don't know this yet, but we suspect the limitation of blood flow to the heart is also overcome when we breathe nasally, because we just don't see that same hyperventilatory response at the same level. And, so here's a scientific sort of idea that's a little complicated. We don't measure in a lab like mine, which is pretty primitive, right? I have a metabolic card. I don't measure arterial blood CO2. I measure something called the end tidal CO2, or the concentration of CO2 when you exhale. So all carts will pretty much do, all metabolic carts will do that. So what's long known in physiology, even to the point where we have predictive equations, is that there's a direct relationship between the amount of CO2 in your exhaled air and the amount of CO2 in your blood. So once the Baylor study came out, I went back and took a look at our data again. And of course, what we're seeing is that in the nasal breathing condition, at an absolute level work, because our subjects were adapted to doing this, at an absolute level where their end tidal CO2s are higher, like 3 millimeters of mercury higher, or 3 points higher, let's just say it that way, enough to substantially suggest that they probably have better blood flow, right? We're not measuring blood flow, we're not measuring arterial CO2, but we can pretty much extrapolate from their end tidal CO2 what their arterial CO2s are, and it's very likely that that also can be extrapolated to the blood flow to their heart. So we have pretty good evidence that it's not only maybe at a relative intensity that as you adapt, it's actually eventually the case that even at an absolute intensity, you probably have improved blood flow to the brain and heart during your exercise. Very protective kinds of ideas.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Well, we better get to number two. What would you say is the second best benefit?
So, the most obvious thing is that in endurance athletes, we see reported occurrences of what's called exercise-induced bronchoconstriction that go as high as 70%. So if you go over into, say, Norway and you look at their junior elites in cross-country skiing, where they're inhaling through their mouths and they're inhaling, you know, cold, dry air that's directly damaging their lung. Virtually, well, the majority of those athletes develop what we used to call exercise-induced asthma, a bronchoconstrictive response. And of course, if they get that, if they're bronchoconstrict, they can't perform very well, right? So even in, you know, say college athletes who are not necessarily an endurance sport, who might, you know, be a basketball player or, you know, a football player or something, we see rates of like 20 to 25%. In the general population of people who don't exercise much, this only happens at about maybe 6 or 7%, right? So we know that the more you're ventilating, and this is with the assumption that almost everybody doing this is ventilating orally, because that's still the common practice when people exercise at a higher intensity. The more you're ventilating, the increased likelihood that you do damage to your lung, and that your body then responds protectively by constricting your bronchi so you can't continue to damage yourself as much. But of course, that impedes your performance and becomes a reason why people stop doing those activities, right? In endurance sport, when you develop significant EIB, initially they treat you with bronchodilators and they'll talk about how successful that is. And initially, many people, it does help overcome the bronchoconstrictive response. But like anything else, you know, any drug that you use over time, you start to downregulate your response to it. They stop becoming as effective. And oftentimes people just drop out. So what we would suggest and what the literature and some of our work suggests now and some old stuff from the 70s and early 80s is that you pretty much eliminate that bronchoconstrictive response, even if it's already developed in you as it was in me, by breathing nasally. Because now the air that hits your lung is in the condition the lung needs to see it, even at high ventilatory rates. It's been humidified to, you know, 100% saturation, and it's been warmed to body temperature, and significant amounts of pathogen or particulate matter, et cetera, have been taken out of it. So essentially that conditioned air hits your lung, and your lung can handle that even if your body already has a bronchoconstrictive response. Because the bronchoconstrictive response definitely seems to relate to a drying thing that happens in the cells and some inflammation starts to begin, and it sets off this whole cascade that all results in your bronchi constricting. But none of that happens when you breathe nasally. So your listeners probably interested in anecdotal. I had an undergraduate student who comes to me, he'd been a cross-country runner, came to me in my exercise phys class. He was in a behavior class where I had to do this project, and he said, well, I'm doing this project in behavior where I'm trying to figure out how to overcome the fact that every time I go out and run, I can barely breathe, right? And I just freaked out. And so, you know, we figured out he had EIB, and then we talked to him about the idea of nasal breathing. He went out and did that the next day. Comes back to me. He had to run very slow, of course. Came back to me the next day, and he's like, this is like a miracle. I haven't gone on a run without having this happen to me in I don't know how long. And then, of course, he adapted to it and eventually became one of our subjects. So, you know, I've had a number of instances of that where, you know, I've just made a suggestion, let's try this, and then their EIB is gone. So, you know, the guys who work on this, the docs who work on this, they're still poo-pooing it. One noted guy particularly said, you know, that's garbage. But, you know, he's just wrong, right? This is so clear-cut. And the evidence actually was in the sciences going back to 79, 81. They just haven't looked at it, right? It's too far in the past, and they're tied to the medical model. Now, having said that, there's a form of EIB. It's not called EIB. It's a laryngeal problem that happens. It's another way the body prevents you from breathing by causing some tightness of your laryngeal tissues, basically your vocal cords, that inhibits you from breathing. And that doesn't respond to nasal breathing in the same way. But the papers on this, the review papers particularly, suggest that this would also not develop if you were potentially breathing nasally. So you can't resolve that simply by adapting to nasal breathing. They use these imaging approaches where they show you what's happening and teach you how to try to, like, essentially teach you a way to try to breathe that prevents it from happening. And it's pretty effective. There's a guy in a group in Denver who do this very, very well. So that occurs more so in females, particularly young. Typical profile would be a young female running cross country, something like that, than it does in males. It's getting more common though, and you have to go at that differently. You can't just start to nasally breathe. You definitely have to go back and do learn the protocols to learn how to use your vocal cords properly in that condition.
But if you're looking to avoid this, your body starting to give you this kind of a reaction, not stressing it unnecessarily by giving it a bunch of dry air or air full of smoke or particles of pollution from that tailpipe that went by you, clear it out as much as you can with your nose, right?
That's exactly right. So I developed this problem way back in the 80s. And initially, you know, the doc said, well, you have asthma, and put me on Theophylline, none of which worked or that I continued because it was horrible. It wasn't until I always had the problem. So I basically just had to, when I was going to ventilate heavily in a session, I had to do it indoors or try to avoid conditions that would tend to stimulate. And then when I, you know, adopted the nasal breathing habit in 2005 and adapted to it over that year, it just went away. Now I've never experienced it since.
Well, that's great. That's great. Okay, so that's two. I'll give you one more. Number three, what's your third biggest benefit of nasal breathing?
Well, for me personally, it was the upper respiratory infection thing, right? And I can't isolate the nasal breathing from the neti pot, right? I suggest you do both. If you are going to adopt nasal breathing, you do produce a lot of mucus, particularly in the early, you know, first year or so of doing this. So using the neti pot every day helps you also to clear your nose so you can breathe more easily and keep that under control. But, you know, the Nobel Prize winner for Ignario, I think is his last name. I can't remember. He had two other partners who they won this Nobel Prize for identifying the role of nitric oxide. When COVID started, he put out a couple of scientific statements suggesting the best protective practice was just to breathe through your nose, right, so that you could address it. But I would suggest that you have to couple that, and you should couple that with using the neti pot every day. And so one of the things we understand about people who do a lot of training is that they become more vulnerable to upper respiratory infection, and that the upper respiratory infections occur at a much higher rate. You know, the original theories about that have been immunosuppression. There's a basis for that, right? Immunosuppression is certainly a part of this. But one of the things we probably haven't looked at is the idea that maybe this is also because they're also breathing orally all the time, right? Maybe if they simply adapted to a nasal breathing practice and use neti pots, that the immunosuppression thing might not carry them over the edge. I get immunosuppressed on occasion. I'm still sometimes, you know, tempted to overtrain, not like deliberately, but because of time and lack of sleep. And I do a lot of things in my life, yet still train a lot. Yet I don't get those infections anymore. And I think I'm protected largely not because of the immunosuppression. I know I still on occasion get that. Although I will say I take my HRV every day now, and I pretty much try to avoid getting immunosuppressed and getting overtrained basically heavily. But I really feel like that's a huge protective thing. So here's another garden variety thing, particularly in new exercisers, but we do see it even in elite endurance athletes on occasion, what's called the stitch, right? You're familiar with what I mean?
Oh, sure.
In the science, we use the term transient abdominal pain, I believe is what's used scientifically. But basically that pain you get in your abdomen, typically on one side or the other, right, when you're running. So we see this most in early runners. Like if you're a phys ed teacher and you make everybody go out and run, half of them will get stitches. But we even see it in highly trained athletes. I had problems with stitches, you know, for years, going from somewhere in the 80s until, again, about 2005, when I would get in hot races, and particularly during the run, right? I would get these stitches to the point where sometimes I'd have to literally walk for a minute or two just to be able to try to finish, right? And, you know, made me crazy because that back in those days, I would win races, right? So then I'd be like trying to win this race, but have to walk. And then some dude would come up on me, right? And so that just made me crazy. I had another elite athlete I worked with some years ago who had the same issue. So that just went away, right? When I started breathing nasally. So no evidence, no trial, no experimental study. But I will say that this elite athlete, it was really the last year I was coaching a guy by the name of Darren Shearer, who was in the WCAP, the World Class Athlete Program, and a very good runner, sub 4 minute mile in high school. You know, we were trying to get him up to the highest level in triathlon. He's running like, you know, basically around a 30 minute 10K off the bike in triathlon, right? At that point, he was one of the fastest guys, although he wasn't a great swimmer, so he was struggling with that part. Anyway, you know, Darren had the same issue. I talked about nasal breathing, but he was like most of the elite athletes. George is a little nuts, so ignore that part and then do the other things he does because they work, right? But then he talked to me about the stitches, and I explained that my stitches had gone away when I started. And then he was all about it, right? Because he'd been in several races where he'd been compromised by it. So within about 6 weeks, we had him running at maybe a 5:10 pace, which is like a 30, 45 or something like that, 10K pace, breathing nasally on in treadmill, you know, 1K or 4 minute, 4 minute intervals on a treadmill. So he adapted relatively quickly, and then he didn't, again, same thing, it resolved, right? He didn't have that problem anymore. So why would that be? So there's all these really, I'll just call them illogical theories about how we get stitches, you know, organ failures and blah, 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 blah. You know, like most things in life, Joe, when we get older, we realize the KISS principle applies. The simplest explanation is the most likely explanation. So the most likely explanation for muscle pain when you need high blood flow is ischemia. So, you know, muscle pain in particular that resolves, right, when you stop using that muscle as much, that's probably ischemia, right? Meaning you're just not getting enough blood flow. So why would you not get enough blood flow? So when I was racing and still breathing orally and would get these stitches, I would hit ventilatory rates like 60 to 80. I'd literally be breathing like this. And so I'd be hyperventilating right through my mouth. And I remember the sensation of my abdomen feeling like it was locking down and that all that breathing was coming from my chest. So one of the things we do anatomically to facilitate a really high level of oral breathing is use our abdomen not as a breathing muscle, but essentially as a control muscle, because we don't use the lower part of the lung. So we start sort of stabilizing the lower thorax with the abdomen. So of course, when that muscle starts to work more isometrically, it's not truly isometric, it's still going to be rhythmic, right? But it becomes more isometric, that impedes blood flow. Right, because when a muscle's under a state of contraction, that also squeezes the blood vessels and impedes blood flow. So very likely what a stitch results from is simply somebody trying to breathe orally, ventilating at a fairly high rate, and having their abdominal muscle blood flow compromised. So when you breathe nasally, that doesn't happen, right? You don't facilitate breathing when you breathe in a way that draws air throughout the entire lung and uses the diaphragm more so, which is what happens when we breathe nasally because of the higher resistance. We also engage our abdomen systematically in that, which is probably why we don't compromise the blood flow and why we don't see the stitches. Now, that's a nice study for some dude who's doing a master's degree or a PhD, right? I haven't done that study. I just have those two anecdotal observations, right? So I'm proffering a theory here, but it's pretty profound in my mind, right? Because I experienced a dramatic change and so did this athlete when we deliberately changed his breathing pattern. So, yeah. You know, I'm hoping somebody takes that up and does a little study of, can you reduce the occurrence of stitches simply by breathing nasally?
Right? Well, it's consistent with the whole perfusion for the brain and the heart idea. I think just with the added complication of the isometric contraction, making it even worse. Yeah, so it's not just hurting you and making you have to stop running in the middle of a race. It's probably damaging that muscle.
Probably so. I mean, anytime you make a muscle too ischemic for too long, that's not a good thing.
Okay, so we're going to run out of time here. Let's focus on the one thing that I think is the most surprising, and that is anybody who's listening here has done high-intensity exercise as hard as they can go, and they feel like the issue is that they're running out of oxygen and that they're breathing harder and harder because they need more and more oxygen, and they feel that hunger for the oxygen. And in the end, that's what fails. They can't bring in enough oxygen and they crack and they have to slow down. So tell us what is really happening there briefly, and then let's talk about building CO2 tolerance.
So that idea, actually that paper just came out looking at, you know, this is just normal oral breathing conditions and max tests, looking at max tests and trying to identify why people were failing. And I think they identified something like 30 to 40% were failing because of air hunger, right? Because they reported that, you know, I couldn't go any further because I wasn't getting enough air. Whereas the majority of people, I think it was something like 60%, had other reasons. So you would say primarily the reason being acidity, right? That they became acidic enough. I don't know how much you've talked about that on your website. The whole idea of creating acidity in the muscle as metabolism elevates, and then the hydrogen ion feeds back to inhibits the proteins, the enzymes that allow us to get energy. So our muscles start to fail, right? And we experience that as just general weakness and difficulty, right? So the majority of people, and I would speculate the majority of well-trained people, although I don't think they took that up in their study, probably fail because of that. But some people fail even breathing orally, even at those high rates where we're favoring getting rid of CO2, clearly because their end-tidal CO2s and arterial CO2s get high enough to make them feel like they don't have enough air. When we test people initially nasally, and we're doing that now, right? We have a new study where we're testing people before they adapt, and then we're going to test them after. We have just one subject who's completed so far because they have to go through a long adaptive period of training. You know, what I suspect we're going to find is that everybody fails breathing nasally because they feel air hunger, right? Because they're not used to the much higher levels of CO2 that they're going to create as a result of breathing more slowly nasally, but that they'll overcome that over time, right? That when they finally regain the ability to go at the same pace or maybe faster that they could orally, that we'll also see that their end tidal CO2s are much higher at that point than they were when they failed in the beginning of the study. So we've seen that in the first subject. We don't, you know, I don't know what we'll see in all our subjects, but I suspect it will be that. So in nasal breathing, that's probably literally always the thing that limits you is air hunger. But if you're an oral breather, that's less likely to be the limit. So does that mean, well, that's the reason why you shouldn't nasally breathe? No, because you can, you know, adapt to CO2, right? You can adapt to not to the sensation. The sensation, you can adapt or down-regulate your response to the sensation goes away over time, right? So you can remove that limitation. I suspect in that paper I mentioned that if they were to look at this, that the people who had that CO2 limitation are probably people who are breathing less and or people who are just less trained, right? Hard to say though, right? Because they didn't, at least in my brief read of the abstract so far, they didn't talk about the idea of categorizing people, I don't think, by their fitness or any of those other variables that might influence this a little bit.
Right. When people, like, let's just say they're holding their breaths, when people have this hunger for air, what they think they have a hunger for is oxygen. And what they really have is their brain is saying, exhale, it's get rid of the CO2.
Right.
It's the sense of the CO2 that is giving you that air hunger.
Yes, it is. That's absolutely accurate. And everything in the body eventually, you know, out of homeostasis, it creates toxicity, right? Every chemical that enters the blood, every, you know, protein, everything, when it gets out of homeostasis, potentially has a negative or toxic effect. So, you know, you shouldn't think of CO2 as a waste gas. It's actually important to be able to tolerate higher levels of it without experiencing the air hunger. But that's a piece of how we adapt, right? So we seem to adapt in two ways. And I'll be able to say this definitively when this current study is done. I can say it speculatively now. We adapt both by increasing our tolerance for CO2, because we definitely are seeing higher end tidal CO2s in our prior study when people hit max breathing nasally than we saw when they hit max breathing orally. But we're also probably improving our ability to ventilate nasally. So if I can ventilate nasally, I won't get as much, you know, buildup of CO2. That's the basic way the body clears CO2, is by ventilating more. So it's a combination of those two things. So, you know, in somebody who, like, you're struggling to get all the way to max, you know, one of the things you can think about is that because I can't get any more tolerant of CO2, that seems unlikely unless you just had extraordinarily high levels. And again, that seems unlikely. Or are you still not able to achieve as much ventilation nasally as you need to do so? Which is why, you know, you can also always add a dilator into the process, right? Something that opens your nasal passage a little bit more forward of the first nasal valve, and that increases ventilation by typically 10 to 15%. There are extreme ones that increase it like 30%. So that's a little complicated idea, but, you know, like if I was talking to you, one of the things I'd suggest is, are you trying to do this with a dilator yet? Have you, like, used a strip on the outside of the nose or a ring that you put inside the nose? And that might be enough to get you a little further without even more adaptation, just because you increase your ventilation. And then I could talk to you about the best strategy. Right. One of the things we understand is that you're only going to be able to do nasal breathing at work that you've adapted to in training. So if you always run breathing nasally, but you're a recreational runner and you always run slow, and I know this is not you, but then you go to race and you try to run faster, you won't be able to breathe nasally. Right. You won't have adapted to that level of work. You have to have done that in training. Right. So the basic way that you adapt in training is intervalizing work that you can't yet do, whether it's about work you can't do breathing nasally or work that you just can't do. Right, you take that work and you intervalize it. You make it into shorter segments that are tolerable, and then your body starts adapting to it. Before you know it, you can do it more continuously. So that's true of the breathing as well.
That seems to be a twofer, where the benefit that you're getting is that you're training your nasal passages to actually function properly because you're using them now for the first time. And the more you use them, the better they get at doing their job. So shorter bits of high intensity
will not overwhelm you, but will give the nasal passages some sort of a stimulus. But the other thing that it gives you is you're getting these bursts of high CO2 that kind of feel uncomfortable, but you start to get used to it, and your comfort, your discomfort will diminish.
Yes.
And now you can do longer intervals over time.
That's exactly right. So the trick is to figure out where that begins to get uncomfortable. So the easy way to do that is what we call a progressive test or a progressive warm-up. Just, you know, like on your bike, if you're measuring power or somehow you measure your work, just go in stages and keep track of, you know, how you feel in terms of your air hunger. And the point starts to get a little uncomfortable. That's the point where you can then maybe intervalize it, right? So let's say, you know, at 250 watts, it starts to feel uncomfortable for you. Then instead of just trying to ride at 250 watts, even though you could normally maybe do that breathing orally, intervalize it, you know, maybe go a minute and then drop the wattage and see if you can do that entirely breathing nasally. And if you can, then before you know it, you'll be doing a longer interval. And then before you know it, you'll be doing the whole thing just continuously. Right? That's what we're doing in the study is we actually, before we retest the subject, we expect them to get up to about a 3 to 4 minute interval at their VO2 max pace from the initial testing, breathing nasally before we consider that they're probably fully adapted.
I wanted to ask you if there are any sort of exercises that maybe would also help with this idea of building CO2 tolerance that maybe are, you know, you could do while you're sitting in your easy chair or something. I mean, one of the things that I have done this year, I started doing it. I would sit in my chair with a pulse ox on my finger and I would breathe shallow for as long as it took me to get my pulse ox to 90 or 89, and then I would breathe shallow enough to hold it there for 5 minutes. Do you think that's having any sort of beneficial effect on my CO2 tolerance?
So you are probably improving your CO2 tolerance by doing that, but what you're looking at is what we call hypoxia. You're looking at your O2 levels. So if you get hypoxic, you know, you also have high CO2 levels, right? So to deal better with hypoxia, you also have to deal with CO2 and have better tolerance for CO2. Is it a worthwhile thing to deliberately create hypoxia? So you indirectly create some limited hypoxia by breathing nasally, but the whole end game is to try to get where you can do the work without getting hypoxic, right? So you can then have that protective feature in how you're exercising. The end game is not just to create hypoxia. So, you know, this is one of the areas where a lot of what's been circulated around this concept is that it's sort of like going to altitude. You know, we have a long body of literature looking at short hypoxic bouts as a way to simulate altitude training. They don't do that, right? They don't create something comparable to what's necessary to altitude train, which is to go and live at altitude, typically for at least 8 to 12 days, 24/7, see the lower levels of arterial oxygen saturation and general hypoxia long enough where that stimulates your body to produce more EPO. And so then you start increasing your red blood cell mass. Short bouts of hypoxia are not doing that. They're not an adequate stimulus. We consider that the stimulus has to be basically around the clock and typically at least a week to 10 days. And that's even in comparison to things like sleeping in tents, right? All the literature on this suggests that that's just not a quite adequate stimulus to produce a big EPO response and to get a significant increase in red blood cell mass. So we've known that, you know, altitude was one of my interests too, because I used that model in training elite athletes when I was still the national team coach and with all the elites I used later. We used what's called a high-low model. So we understood that, you know, it was not going to be beneficial if you were going to use a tent or do hypoxic training, that you needed to come up to altitude and live. And then we needed to figure out a way for you to actually perform work at the power outputs that you could produce at lower levels. And we did that using oxygen here because you can't get down to a low level from Colorado Springs really rapidly. But you can use oxygen that let you perform work that you normally couldn't do at this altitude.
I see.
That topic is like a whole podcast in and of itself. But so anyway, there is a benefit, though, in terms of nasal breathing and altitude that I would speculate about. And I am very strongly interested in this because of research I did in my PhD program that I was a part of as a student. So one of the things we understand is that when we improve our CO2 tolerance a lot by breathing nasally, as we ascend rapidly, like if you go up a mountain on a run or, you know, you're a climber or something like that, where things go wrong is when your body kind of reacts highly to the fact that you're getting more acidic and you're having a higher CO2 level and you try to compensate with a lot of respiration. and then you dehydrate, and then, you know, all kinds of things go wrong, leading all this all leads into what's called acute mountain sickness, right? But we understand that these people who actually have very high CO2 tolerance, Sherpas, for instance, that that doesn't happen to them, that their body doesn't overcompensate in that way when they go to altitude. And it's not like they live at 21,000 feet. You know, they're living typically at 10,000 or 12,000. So, you know, we have some formal experimental work on this. I talk about it in the study. I was actually involved in one of those studies. If we actually get really good at having a higher CO2 tolerance and being able to breathe through our nose, we probably can ascend with less of that immediate effect more safely. And also we're protecting ourselves from that cold, dry air more effectively as well. So if you're a person who does that, which I've been doing my entire time living in the West, right? I love to run in the mountains and ride up into the mountains. You know, then I think you're probably protecting yourself. We also use those high altitude exposures to stimulate EPO. And if actually somebody like me goes to altitude now, I probably won't get the same EPO response I would have if I didn't adapt myself in the way that I did, because I won't, my body won't react in the way that then tells the brain, you know, allows me to get hypoxic, drop my arterial oxygen saturations, and tells the brain produce more EPO. I probably wouldn't. Now that's speculative, but I do know the first part is actually very real, not only from my own experience, but also from experimental work I talked about in the book. I've been occasionally on the website that the mountain runners and the ultra runners are most enamored of. And there's a whole huge thing about all, you know, the high rates of EIB and all those athletes. It's like all of them get it. And so I suspect that if they would simply adopt a nasal breathing practice, that we'd see the incidence of that drop very, very low, if not to zero, even though they're going up in the worst possible conditions.
Amazing. Well, George, I would love to keep talking about this all night long, but I better let you run back to your life. And so before we go, though, tell our audience how they can find your book.
It's called The Nasal Breathing Paradox. So if you Google that, you'll find it. A bunch of booksellers have it. Barnes has it, and a bunch. And then maybe you'll put the link on your website or something.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's how you find it.
All right. So everybody listening to this, this might feel like this is old news, and it's so boring now, and you're on to the next thing. But this is important. This is worth your time. You know, in my own personal experience, this is hard and you got to stick with it, but there's a payoff. I already feel like my stress level is better. I sleep better because I nasal breathe while I'm sleeping, and I'm going to redouble my efforts. I'm going to start doing intervals, which is what I haven't been doing. And so the intervals, I think, is the key that will get me to where I'm nasal breathing when I exercise 100% of the time. George, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Joe.
Been great. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. George Dallam. You can find more information about Dr. Dallam and how to find his book in the show notes.